Good evening to all my good evening to all my listeners of Wise Women Media, the radio show. Thank you for joining us for yet another installment of the Wise Women. And I want to remind you all that you can see us online at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. And I just want to give a shout out to our sponsors, the Daughters of Isis, Florida Nature Photos, Here Be Monsters, who gives us the platform to broadcast on, Power New Media and Public Relations, Roundtree 7, Tarot and Stars, and the Hoodooed Blog. Our special guest tonight should be joining us shortly. Her name is Pat LaMarche. I'll tell you a little bit more about her in just a bit, but I wanted to play a song first. So our musical interlude tonight will be Grace Potter and Daryl Hall, Room to Breathe. Y'all liked that. That was Grace Potter and Daryl Hall doing Room to Breathe, and I believe Pat's on the line with us. Pat, are you with me?
I am. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Glad you could join us tonight. I just want to remind people before we start the interview that if you want to call in and ask Pat any questions, The number to call in is 213-816-0357. Again, 213-816-0357. You can join us in the chat and you can post your questions there. And, of course, this show is available forever in the archives if you can't listen to the whole show or to actually send the show out to anybody else. You can just forward the link. So Pat has been very busy over the course of probably the past 10 years. She ran for vice president for the Green Party. And since then has really found a niche in working with the homeless. Actually, Pat, you've always worked with the homeless, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've worked on poverty issues as a journalist for a couple of decades, and I was brought up by a mom who couldn't let you have a decent meal without reminding you that somebody else was hungry. So pretty much my adult life, I volunteered at shelters. My mom would buy food, and once a month my kids and I would cook dinner for about 40 people at a local shelter. So, I was a single mom, so my mom paid for it, and kids and I cooked it. And it was funny because one time I said to my little children, "Hey, who wants to make cupcakes?" And none of them moved, you know, neither my daughter nor my son moved. And I said, "Hey, don't you make cupcakes?" And they just looked at me, and I said, "What's the matter?" And they said, "Are they for us or are they for the homeless?"
Wow.
Getting a little sick for cooking food for everybody else. But it's just always sort of been something I've cared about. And so when we decided to run for president and vice president, David Cobb and I, one of the things I wanted to make sure was, knowing we weren't going to win and being fairly certain that was probable, getting beaten by a man who shot his friend in the face, though, was a little painful. When we figured we were going to run, I just really wanted to spend a year not just spinning my wheels, working on ballot access stuff and ballot status in different states, which is the real reason you run top of the tickets, but doing something that would send a message out. And so poverty being a real big deal to me, I thought the best way I could run my campaign was to live in homeless shelters while I was running for vice president, and that's what I did. And then in 2006, I wrote a book about the experience, which is called Left Out in America. And a man in central Pennsylvania read my book and offered me the opportunity to come down here and run a shelter, and that really rounded out my experience quite a bit. Because day to day, every single day, dealing with the issues and the choices and the sadness and the humiliation and the anger and the fear of homelessness, you really get, a much better idea of what life is like for probably about 5 million Americans than you do just by doing a news story on them or volunteering once a month.
Do you think the numbers have radically increased over the course of, since 2004, since you did that tour to now?
Well, definitely think that the numbers have increased a lot, especially since the great economic decline of 2008, the big stock market crash. But the other problem is the numbers that we're told are inaccurate anyway. There's a point in time count that's done all across the country in January, and that's where Housing and Urban Development gets the number for homelessness. Is there's a one night that caseworkers and church leaders and volunteers and everybody go out into the community and they count homeless. And the number is around 650,000. And so that's the number that goes to Congress. That's the problem they think is out there. And 650,000 is a big number. But that is such a gross underestimation because the most important thing to an awful lot of homeless people is to not be counted. The Department of Education for the federal government has the McKinney-Vento Homeless Education Act, and homeless kids have special rights. They get to stay in their school. They get a free lunch. They get a box of food to take home on the weekend. They get special things guaranteed by law in the McKinney-Vento Homeless Education Act. And so parents are much more willing, not totally willing, but more willing to tell the school that they're homeless than they are to tell other individuals. And so the Department of Education, in the same exact government as HUD, says there are 1 million, over 1 million homeless school children. Well, how can there be 1 million homeless school children when there are only 650,000 homeless people? So we know that number's, you know, ridiculous. If there are 1 million homeless school children, there've got to be at least another million homeless babies and toddlers.
Right.
And then at least a million parents. And then there are the veterans and the elderly and the blah, blah, blah. So I think the number's probably closer to 5 million.
It might even be more than that, because I've noticed you made the comment that a lot of them don't want to be counted. Mm-hmm. And in certain cities, I can name St. Petersburg, for instance, which is here in the Tampa Bay area. You know, they routinely move the homeless out of the city where they're sleeping on the streets or sleeping in Williams Park, which is typical because they've done the homeless have been there for years. But they continually... the authorities make that a crime, move them out, and then when there is an official count, there's no way that it can be accurate because the homeless are literally scattered in different places outside of the city proper. So who can get an accurate count on that? And then Hernando County, did I lose you, Pat? I think I lost you. Hello? Well, we'll wait until Pat calls back in, but it looks like somehow the call was dropped. I don't know if it was her cell phone or whether it was a technical issue on my end. I'm going to go ahead and open up this article and kind of scan it. Oh, there she is again. Hi, Pat.
Hey, sorry, I lost you.
I don't know what happened there. I don't know if it was on your end or my end. So I don't know how far I spoke, but
you
I
were
did
just talking about Petersburg, yeah.
The St. Petersburg homeless are scattered because they're routinely driven out of the city proper. So anybody doing a count doesn't get an accurate count.
Right.
And then
right.
Where I live in Hernando County, I'm getting information from somebody that's actually helping the homeless that don't want to be counted. They're actually living in the woods. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, the kids will come out of the woods and go to a feeding at one of the churches, and they take food for their parents. But I really believe that a lot of people are very afraid of DCF and losing their kids, and that's why they remain hidden. And from what I understand, the laws are different on that situation in every state. In some states, if you're homeless and you can't care for your children, DCF will step in and take them. Do you know of any state in particular that's actually doing that right now? Or
It goes on in about half the states. But you said an interesting sentence, and the sentence was, if you're homeless and you can't take care of your children, which are two different things, and I know you know that, but you know, if you're homeless, you're poor, and you need a place to live. For the most part, you're homeless because you can't afford a home, and that's the whole story. And so what all these states do, Pennsylvania is one of them, Arkansas, there are plenty of states that take kids away from homeless parents, is they spend about $40,000 per child per year on foster care when all they need is $12,000 for an apartment for a year.
Right.
And that would be a good apartment. So it's the laws that punish the poor. The poor must be doing this to themselves. They're bringing it on themselves. They can't manage their lives. They've screwed up somehow. It's not that they make 7 1/4 at McDonald's and they only get 30 hours a week. It has to be their fault, and we have to believe it's their fault, or else we'd have to believe that it could happen to us.
Right.
And so this punishing reality is what's really behind taking kids away from parents who are just too poor to give them a roof. Like, not having a house is made better by not having a mom? Are you kidding?
Yeah, right. I had a patient, actually, that I spent a lot of time with. He's since deceased, but I remember we were watching a news story about the homeless in St. Petersburg, as a matter of fact, and he was extremely conservative in his thinking, and he made a comment about those people are just drug addicts, and if they're not drug addicts and alcoholics, then they just want to be like that. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I said, nobody wants to be poor. Who in the world would want to be poor or prefer to be poor? I mean, who would want to live on the streets and not have a roof over their head? It just didn't make any sense to me what he was saying. But unfortunately, these are the thoughts of a lot of very conservative people. And I hear this saying all the time, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, how can you do that when there's no jobs? You know, or no
how can you
jobs?
Do that when you're 3 months old?
Yeah.
You know, what 3 months old is able to rectify the problem right now? I mean, that's the other thing is you hear about, you know, I don't want those people living on my dime or all this other stuff. Those people you're talking about are, the vast majority of them are children.
Yeah, I heard that. It was supposed to be like five homeless children to one homeless adult when you break down the number. I don't know if that's correct or not, but it seems to me I heard a number like that.
Well, it's interesting because the homeless children end up in foster care, and then sometimes are added to the number that way. But the National Coalition for the Homeless says that the average homeless person is 9 years old.
Wow.
And that's because there are so many infants. So this is average, right? You're averaging out the ages. There are so many homeless infants and toddlers that it pulls the curve on the age way down. So the average person who's homeless is 9? I mean,
right.
So the average person in poverty is a child. So
right.
Diane Nyland, a wonderful friend of mine who runs the National Advocacy for Homeless Children, says we must be an incredibly, incredibly wealthy nation to throw away our children.
Yeah.
We have all the commodities to throw away.
She's been on our show. She was actually on our show, it was more than a year ago, that much I know. But it was extremely enlightening, you know, what she's been doing. And, you guys have teamed up how many times now, you and Diane?
We've teamed up for two trips, one to the southeast that we called the Southern Discomfort Tour. And then most recently we went to the desert southwest on the Babes of Wrath tour.
A lot of differences being in the southwest versus being in the southeast. What would you say, is there any difference in the, like, say, the homeless shelters or the job situation or how they treat their people rather than, I'm down in the southeast, so I actually met up with you guys when you were here in the southeast.
Yeah.
But what's different? What makes the southwest any different, or is there just so many similarities?
There are so many similarities anyway. But I mean, when you've got millions and millions and millions of something, it gets homogeneous. But I would say that probably the finest shelter in the country is in the southwest, and that's You Mom in Phoenix. And that's probably the best shelter in the country. It's got 155 families, about 600 people. It has a state-of-the-art daycare center. They're just wonderful, and they put people back on the road to rebuilding their lives. The problem is, unless you can all of a sudden double someone's wages, the chances of a family getting out of homelessness and getting right back into it again within a couple of years are very great. So you have this chronic homelessness that's a problem. Chronically homeless people live an average of 30 years less than people who aren't homeless. It's a public health problem to have so many people be homeless.
Right.
You know, the scope of this, and then, you know, I wrote in my book, I was in homeless shelters in New York City. And there, the point in time count in New York City this year had 50,000 homeless people one night in New York City. So let's say that's right by one-sixth. So it's 300,000 people, which is probably a minimum, 300,000 people on the island of Manhattan are homeless. So
right.
There
now,
are,
how has that changed?
There are thousands of fast food restaurants. Where do you think the person who made your cheeseburger lives?
Right, right.
Do you believe they have an apartment in Manhattan?
Right.
You know, and if it's not discomforting to you that, that fast food employees and power retailers are employees are homeless, then you should just eat your cheeseburger, you know, because you don't have to worry about hygiene problems. You don't have to worry about this person having, you know, inadequate access to getting cleaned up before they come to work. You don't have to worry about anything because you don't even dream of the fact that that person who's cooking your food has nowhere to live.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Let me. We have a caller from area code 618. Let me patch them in. Hi, caller. I'm speaking to the caller with a 618 area code. What's your name and where you're calling? Where are you calling from?
Well, hi. Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. My name is Kathy, and I live in Southern Illinois. And hi, Pat. I have been following you and Diane.
Oh, great.
On your Babes of Wrath tour. I thought it was fantastic. I've been homeless myself briefly. I lost a job and had two children. And my husband at the time, his mother allowed him to go live with her, but me and the children were not allowed to. So, you know, by default, I became homeless. And ended up here in Southern Illinois. And I want to tell you, this has been one heck of a learning experience for the last 30 years of my life. This is not something that just happened overnight. This is something that happened beginning in the 80s, especially when you had all of these, especially with Reagan and this whole push to punish really working class people. And we found our wages being depressed, as Pat eloquently talked about. Our wages, our hours of work, the types of jobs. When I came to Southern Illinois, it was very difficult to even find a job or even get an application for a job. And also the jobs started disappearing. And they not only went over the border, the increase in technology. I used to work at a phone company, and I was a phone operator, a long-distance phone operator. Well, if you know now, if you call long distance, you do not get a human being on the other end of the line. So this is another problem. It's not just that we have fast food places or low-wage jobs. We have a lack of jobs. And we have so many homeless people here, also living in the woods, living in families' basements, doubling up in their bedrooms and on their sofas. So this is not something that is going to go away overnight. Michigan, for example, where you used to have a lot of industrial jobs, I think they have a total of 400,000 in the entire state now. You used to have 100,000 workers just in one plant. So we are looking at a real systemic problem. And I really, really just want to commend you and Diane for what you're doing to really bring this to light. And keep up the good work.
Thanks for that. I appreciate you saying that. And I lost you for a minute, and you were talking about how this is a 30-year learning curve for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the average person who is so already overwhelmed and so desperate, there is a theory that you have to keep an abject poverty class in order to keep the lower classes in place. You know, I have a crappy job, I've got no benefits, I've got no health benefits, I've got a lump in my armpit, I can't get it checked, but at least I'm not homeless, right? And so in order to keep the lower classes in check, you have to have a class that's just completely at rock bottom. And that's a theory, and that's, you know, that's like, oh, wow, no one would be that diabolical. It just works out that way by accident. But what you're saying about all those jobs leaving the United States, all those manufacturing jobs, all of us being interdependent and then dependent on each other, that has kind of slipped the, you know, slipped the notch on on what people have for understanding anymore. We're taught to be angry at each other and to blame each other. What's wrong with my life? It's that woman over there on food stamps. And we're really taught to just beat the living daylights out of each other. And when loving each other and understanding each other and just being grateful that for what little bit we've got and the fact that we have people around us to share it with, would go so much further to solving the problems. But it's a diabolical reality that as long as I can blame the guy on who's got two little kids and he's got to get an assistance check, as long as I can blame him, I don't ever have to try and understand the concept of a CEO making $50 million to take my job away.
Right.
You know, these guys get bonuses for people losing their job.
Yep, exactly.
And that is so hard to understand. It's so much easier to understand being angry at somebody else for putting food on their kid's table.
And as you said, it's the children too that suffer the most, and the children are the bulk of the homeless. So I always, when somebody starts talking about how bad the homeless problem is, and they should all get a job, it must be something they're doing to make themselves homeless. I want to shake them and just say, "What about the kids? You know, they didn't make this happen. And who in their right mind would want to be in that situation?" As I said before, nobody wants to be poor. Everybody wants to feed their kids and take care of their kids and have a roof over their head. Nobody wants.
Well,
to
Well, the other thing to remind people is they do have jobs.
Right, right.
They do have jobs. I ran a shelter where more than 50% of the people in the shelter had a job. Well, for crying out loud, 35% of the people in the shelter were too young to work. So another 50% have a job, which means I only had 15% of my shelter was on. I had people throwing on uniforms to go to every manner of fast food joint and every other place, leaving for work and leaving through the shelter front door and going to work. These people do have jobs. They just don't have jobs that will pay for them to have a place to live. And we, because of our shelter society and our forcing these people underground, like your caller said, forcing them out to live into the woods, forcing them to hide so they don't lose their children, because of this forced hiding, we as a society are subsidizing and supporting extremely low-wage jobs, subsidizing those vast profiteers who make money off of keeping people working for a wage that won't provide them a home. And then we shelter them so that the people can afford to keep working for nothing.
Right.
It's such a complicated but ridiculous, constant, circular feeding motion that keeps this ridiculous system in place. And Howard Zinn, who wrote The People's History of the United States, he said that the only way for a nation to become truly imperialist is by having a third world at home. If you want to be imperialist, you have to export your goods out to other countries. Our new markets are China and India.
Right.
Those are the markets where people are going to have enough money to buy things. And international corporate reality has given up on the people of the United States, in my opinion. And if they continue to dismantle our environmental laws, there isn't even going to be a safe place to drink water. And
yeah,
all of this sounds so huge and upsetting that people want to just turn the radio off and say, "I can't hear this anymore because I can't fix it," you know?
As one of the people that's been actively fighting for even the human impact of the Gulf oil spill to be mentioned, I mean, I've been following this since April 20th, 2010, and not only are they talking, and just in my own backyard, I mean, first we had the drones that I had to go and do a city council meeting with probably 3 weeks ago. Now they're talking about fracking in the state of Florida. How can they frack in Florida? Florida's like a sandbar. There's no like stone underneath. We have saltwater immersion. It's not even a secure landmass when you look at it. Most of it is
and
a
the price
bar.
Of gas is going down. This gas isn't even being used in the United States. It's just like the coal that is now going out to China. And
this stuff in Western Europe, we aren't even using the resource. We are destroying this country to export to outside markets. We are destroying our country and this beautiful natural resource that we stole from the Native Americans. And
right.
Now, and we're doing it for the bottom line profit of somebody who's got an office in the Cayman Islands. And it's mind-boggling, and that's the key to it. That's how it's so successful, because if you talk to the average person, it's like saying, I'm going to teach you trigonometry right now. Their eyes glaze over. They say, please, God, no, I got out of that when I was a junior in high school. I never want to think about that again. And they just are so overwhelmed by the information. And it's so upsetting, and they turn to their leaders, absolute jackasses like John Boehner, and they turn to them and they say, you know, lead me out of this and don't tell me about it because I can't understand. And then, you know, the powers that be own the people like John Boehner and the rest of them, Nancy Pelosi, could pick one side or the other. They're all selling us down the river. And it's overwhelming. And that's why I believe politics is a noble craft that we need to take back, you know, tooth and nail. We need to get back a hold of our government. We are the government. We cannot allow this to keep happening to us. Even if you're Marnie Glickman out in California, who's running for sewer board, these are the very low level jobs that politicians, if we get the right people in there, they're actually going to make sure your water's clean. I want to do a shout out to Ginny too, who's texting us from downtown Los Angeles, who was a huge help to me on my Left Out tour back in 2004. I was on Skid Row again this past time. I mean, did you guys see The Soloist with Nathaniel Ayers?
No.
He's the young Juilliard-trained musician. A movie was made. Robert Downey Jr. played the Steve Lopez, the L.A. Times reporter, who finds this Juilliard-trained musician on the streets in Skid Row.
Oh, no, I got to see that.
Yeah, I think it was Jamie Foxx played Nathaniel Ayers. Well, I was on Skid Row a couple of months ago when I was on the Babes of Wrath tour, and I met Nathaniel Ayers. Guess what? He's still on Skid Row.
Wow.
we're all led to believe that there are happy endings for these people. There isn't even a happy ending for the guy who ended up in a Hollywood movie.
Right. Wow. That's amazing. That's an amazing story. What do you think is going to how can I phrase this question? What do you think is going to happen within the next 2 to 3 years economically? Because from what I see, Occupy was just the beginning. Occupy began because of the economic disparity. Mm-hmm. People with their foreclosed homes becoming homeless, students finally realizing that they were indebted for the rest of their lives if they took school loans to get a degree, so they could get a job at the end of their education, which, of course, we know there's no jobs. So within 2 or 3 years, where do you see us going financially? Do you see the economic spiral continuing downward?
You know, I have to sigh and breathe so heavily. Obviously, I'm a Green Party member. I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat. And so I can't put a lot of hope in those guys. But it doesn't change the fact that when I saw that beautiful black family walking down the street on inaugural day, January 20, 2009, I was proud of my country. For the first time that I can remember in a little while, I was genuinely proud of the voters of the United States of America that weren't racist. And, I can't voice disappointment enough with President Obama. It's all about my uterus now. Either I vote for the party that wants to tell my uterus what to do, whether it's fall in love with another person with a uterus or not, or I get to go for the party that lets me have my own mind about my uterus. Those are my choices now. Otherwise, economically, these two parties are identical. And when President Obama, when he leads, when his best punch is giving away the store,
giving away the raises that are so desperately needed by Social Security recipients, when that's how he leaves, when he leaves with selling the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA, the one of the best investments the government ever made, where we get millions and millions of dollars of return on our investments still to this day, when those are his leading punches, we are screwed. And there's no other or more polite way to put it. We're just screwed by this whole thing right now. And so economically, what do I see? I don't know. Bernie Sanders launches a coup and we have a hope. I think we've got to get to the streets. In 2008, I was campaigning with Mike Gravel, Senator Mike Gravel, who was running for president.
Oh, yeah. I met him, actually. Yeah, I know.
I
met him when I was working with Dennis Kucinich, and we were all up in New Hampshire. And actually, yeah. We ended up in the VA hospital, and we were in different cubicles together. We were separated by a curtain. I had strep, and he had a sinus infection. It was kind of hilarious. But, you know, we kind of waved. We didn't want to shake each other's hands.
Well, I'll tell you, there is no finer American still alive right now than Mike Gravel. We still have a hero among us, and that's important. He's the man who ended the Vietnam War. He's the man who saved Daniel Ellsberg's life by reading the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record. He was tried for treason in the Supreme Court as a seated U.S. senator and found not guilty of treason because of the Pentagon Papers. He's a hero. He's a man who understands what his job was. And I'm campaigning with him. He was the last one standing when it was just Obama and President Obama and Hillary Clinton still in the running. And Mike Gravel, he hung on. And I was down at Harvard with him. And he's speaking to the Harvard Young Democrats. And these are the best and the brightest and allegedly the most liberal of our intellectual elite youth. And they were stuffed shirts in the making. You know, I was like, hey, guess what, kids? We're at war. You know, put down your backpack with your laptops in it and get out in Route 128 outside Boston and stop traffic. You know, you have to stand up now. We're murdering people who didn't do anything to us. We're slaughtering them. For the military-industrial complex, you have got to get in the streets. These are the kids who ought to be getting it.
Right, they're not getting it. They're not.
And how did we lull our youngest generation into complacency?
Good question. Is it the riches of being in the so-called richest nation on earth, which I don't think that's true anymore, but. You know, when you have all these conveniences and you have all these electronics and you have these people that can afford to go to Harvard, for instance, they have money. They probably come from families with money. So they have no idea.
Yeah. Harvard also, though, gives away more scholarships than pretty much any other university. So there ought to be a lot of kids there that don't have money. I think two things. We didn't have a draft for these wars. So nobody had any skin in the game except somebody who was already screwed into it to begin with, the backdoor draft with the National Guard. But then on top of that, we're accomplices. Everyone who gets in a car and drives down the street believes this war is for oil, believe that the Iraq war was for oil. They swallowed hook, line, and sinker the BS about whether or not we were in Afghanistan for any higher reason. If that war was about Osama bin Laden, then shouldn't the war be over? You know, all these things that we were fed is because, you know, we're in a bad marriage. We're believing the lies we're told because doing anything about them would have to break the family up. We're doing that denial sort of ownership thing. And it's like the whole country needs a really good therapist to stop being codependent on these people who are doing wrong in our name.
Well, that's, I was going to use that term codependent almost exactly like a codependent wife of, you know, a woman beater. You know, we keep getting beaten down and going back for more. And I believed, I definitely believe the wars and occupations have been for oil and natural resources. That goes without saying. But I also believe
it's also to sell bullets. It's also to sell bullets. It's to sell tanks.
Military-industrial complex. And now the culture of war has been ingrained into our younger generation, and it's extremely frightening in its scope because, for instance, I work with a family as a part-time nanny, and these children, when they got the horrible game over Christmas time, Call of Duty, which really... The younger kid thinks that when he goes into the military, and this is an expected thing, that he's going to go into the military, that he's not going to be able to die, that he's going to be able to do all these things that he does on the video games, and he's not going to die.
You know, Anita, you've got to be the hardest working person I've ever heard of, by the way.
I'm the hardest, let me tell you, I'm the hardest working person. And I'm making probably about, when it averages out, probably $7 or $8 an hour. So I've actually myself been unemployed for a year and a half now. So
is a big problem. I mean, even hardworking people are technically unemployed, even if you're doing five jobs.
Yeah, if you're doing five jobs, if you're doing eight jobs, 10 jobs, I'm picking up certain things here and there, but nothing that can even pay a bill is what I bring home. I can't even pay the bills. So it's a situation where I'm very grateful that I have a little bit of money coming in where I can pay the rent. You know, otherwise. And in fact, when I saw you on your Southeast tour, I was homeless at that time, I think.
Wow.
No. I had just moved. That was about 6 months before. It was February, I think.
Yeah, it was February.
Yeah, February 2011.
Yeah,
11. Yeah. So
you know, you bring up an important point, though, and I think that it might go back to the psyche thing that we need to evaluate for people. Hitler didn't have a video game.
Right, right.
And none of the people who operated Auschwitz saw mean movies, saw Die Hard. You know, we have a murdering culture that's ingrained as humans. And somewhere along the line, we've got to get a handle on why it's so easy for us to point a finger and throw somebody else into the circular blades. Where is it that it's okay to bomb the Iraqis or the Afghanis or the Pakistanis? And then why are we so incredibly stupid that when we see a Washington Post headline that says, studies show drone bombings turning world attention against us, we're surprised. How did that get to be a headline?
And how do people not expect us to incur some blowback with all of that? I mean, we've got, you know, nations over there, certainly not all the people that live in these countries, but a lot of them, if there's been a death or something that's affected them personally as a result of the wars and occupations that we're perpetrating on their country, then don't we think that there's going to be blowback from all of that, that something's not going to happen to us in the interim, or our troops that are over there, of course. You know, our troops over there are sitting ducks, basically, which is even more, all the more reason why we shouldn't have ever gone there. We shouldn't be there. We should be bringing our troops home now. That's
absolutely.
You know, we need to bring them home, and it's way, way, way past time. But like you said, this is to sell armament. This is to continue the military-industrial complex, and then when you come here, we have the prison complex. So between the military-industrial complex and the prison complex, we've got everybody at the top making money on the backs of the poor. And that's where it ultimately ends up, is on the backs of the poor.
I'd like to give the United States of America a summer reading list. You know, we'll continue being kind of adrift until next September when you finish the reading on your reading list. And one of the things I'd like to recommend to people to read is Peter Van Buren's book, How I Helped Lose the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, I think is something like that. But anyway, he was a State Department employee who was sent to Iraq with literally, you know, boxes and bags of money. And he, you know, he details how he was trying to hand cash to somebody whose son we had just blown to smithereens, as though we could buy these children's lives out of memory from the parent, you know, and all these other things, wastewater treatment plants that we blew up so that everybody's water's been contaminated. Just incredible things, and then the ridiculous amounts of money that we lost. But another book I would recommend for the United States of America summer reading list is Hocus Pocus by Kurt Vonnegut, which back in the 50s and 60s, or whenever he wrote that book, early 60s, he talked about how the United States government was going to have for-profit jails. They were going to privatize the jails. We were going to have for-profit jails. And then it was going to be profitable to incarcerate our own population. So guilt and innocence really become unimportant because there's a profit margin and a bottom line to incarcerating our own population. And that profit will be made by corporate America or corporate worldhood. And he talks about how they need so much prison space, but they don't need the colleges anymore because the kids can't afford it, that they turn the colleges into prisons.
Oh, that's spooky.
This book was written decades ago.
There's another book that was written back in 1993, and it talks about the financial situation. It talks about sustainable communities. It talks about the stewards, which are kind of like a combination of Blackwater and Homeland Security. It talks about the rampant pedophilia. It talks about pretty much all of the social abnormalities, and it's called The Fifth Sacred Thing by Starhawk. So I think that should be added to the reading list, too.
Okay. That's
and
going
it was
on the
an incredible
list.
Book. Like I said, it was written, I think, in 1993 by Starhawk. I have met her. She is currently trying to put that book in movie form. It definitely has a spiritual aspect to the book, too. But if you're not spiritual and you don't want to, you know, you can actually glean over it or skim over it and go to the meaty parts. But very, very scary as how most of those scenarios written about in the book are coming true today. And it's a lot of parallels. Incredible. And I did ask Starhawk about the book when the first time I met her. She had made a comment to me that it was a collection of her visions for the future. And I thought, wow, she's pretty spot on. And for those of you that are familiar with Starhawk, of course, now she's really leading the way in lots of communities across the United States and even in the Middle East and Europe about sustainable communities and the use of permaculture and definitely getting people going. In fact, she was supposed to be going to the Middle East very soon. She might be there already. Probably Palestine and Israel. So with her travels, she's well-known throughout the community in permaculture. So I highly recommend that book, The Fifth Sacred Thing. And there is a sequel called Walking to Mercury, I think is the name of it. I have not read that yet, and that's definitely on my list to read. But for those of you who enjoy something spiritual in addition to kind of like, I would call it science fiction. It was written as science fiction in 93, but now it's true.
Amazing. And, Skype is true now, too, in the 2001 Space Odyssey. The dad calls home for the birthday party, and he can watch his daughter on the screen, and, that's Skype. So, a lot of science fiction is just like, yeah, bring it on. I want a tricorder. You know, I don't want to have my brain opened up. Dr. McCoy just, like, waves stuff over people's heads. So we are an intelligent life form, and we ought to be able to move forward with the things that are good for us, not move forward with the things that aren't. And the only thing is we've got to overcome our own base instincts to have our kinder, better nature show.
And we've got to give up on all the guilt and all the fear and all the anger that we feel towards ourselves, self-loathing, but the way we hate each other. And that brings me to another book for the reading list for the summer, which is East of Eden by John Steinbeck.
Oh, that's an oldie but goodie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and it's wonderful. East of Eden will explain to you why you believed, if you believed George Bush and the yellow cake from Niger, it will explain to you why you believed it. It will explain to you why you believe President Obama when he tells you this is the only way he can get it done. It's the buying into what your abuser is telling you. And I think it's my favorite book. And, you know, when that book ended, it was like John Steinbeck took my friends away. I loved the character so much. But in addition, it just explains, chapter 8 is probably the best written chapter in the history of the English language, I think. It just explains what a monster is. And when you realize what a monster is, you can see the monsters in your society around you. George Bush was a monster. Dick Cheney was a monster. Nancy Pelosi is a monster, and she was a monster the day she took an impeachment off of the table.
Right.
And these are the things that we have to start acknowledging about our own society so that we can be better.
Now, you're a green and I'm a green, and I want to talk to you as a green for a moment. How do you get past talking to other activists that refuse to get out of the Democratic, with a big D, mindset? What do you do? Because they still believe, after all this time, that Obama is their savior, and he's going to take care of them, and he's going to fix everything and make it right. They don't even seem to realize he's not going to be in office in 2016. He's going to be gone. So how do you get past that? How do you get into conversations with these people? Because I find it increasingly difficult to engage them in any kind of political conversation.
Well, the first thing I don't do is I don't accuse them of having a bad motive.
Right.
I don't think they stick up for President Obama because they're bad people. I don't even think President Obama is a bad person.
Right.
I think that there's a cave-in at every level, and everybody's got their price. I remember when people used to attack Jesse Jackson because he wasn't the man he should have been. Well, he was the man who wiped Martin Luther King's blood off his face. So, you know, I mean, everyone has a price. It's not always money. So I don't know what President Obama's price is. I don't know why it's been paid. I do know, though, that the compromise has to stop. Somebody, everybody, should be willing to be a one-term elected official. They have to realize that they've got to do the right thing, even if big money will take them out the next time an election comes. We have to admit there are stolen elections. And I just try and speak reasonably to people because I can't change their mind by being angry at them. And I try to say, you know, Howard Dean's election was stolen. Bobby Kennedy's election was stolen. But thank God they don't have to shoot you anymore to steal your election. They just character assassinate you like they did Howard Dean. And then to the next thing, which is the ballot box, where votes are again stolen. The Green Party, the Cobb-LaMarche campaign in 2004 did the recount of Ohio and proved that Ohio was stolen. Proven in a court of law in 88 counties. But it didn't matter. Nothing changed. And so at some point, and we recounted it because John Kerry wouldn't. So at some point, we've got to say, these are the realities that face us. If you really believe President Obama is your savior, then for some reason he's not saving you. So if you're drowning and the lifeguard has come to save you and you don't get saved, why is that? Are you kicking and thrashing and not letting him save you? Are you not kicking and thrashing the right way so that he can swim the 10 miles with you? Because now we're really far out in oil-drenched sea.
Mm-hmm.
What part of him not saving you are you willing to own as your own problem that you can fix? And maybe that is calling the White House every single day and saying, by the way, I'm not saved yet. Where's the solution? Why are you cutting LIHEAP more than Congress wants to? the low-income heating assistance program. Why are you cutting Social Security when Congress doesn't want to? George Bush in his memoir said that trying to cut Social Security destroyed his legacy. He doesn't even think it's the wars.
Yeah.
But President Obama can cut Social Security?
Yeah, it's almost like Obama has stepped in and done every single thing that Bush was going to do and probably didn't complete. So, you know, a lot of people think that this Bush, they think that the Bush-Clinton alliance is a new thing as well. So, you know, there's a big rumor, of course, that Hillary's going to be running in 2016, and then there's another big rumor that Jeb Bush is going to be running in 2016. And I think Laura Bush on an interview just within the past couple of days said, "Oh, a Bush against a Clinton in a presidential race, that should be interesting." And I saw this on Twitter, and I responded on Twitter to somebody. I said, "But it's been done before. This isn't new." You know, and it's,
you know,
have people forgotten their history? I mean, that wasn't that long ago, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing I try to tell people who are in one of the two political parties is, well, what I try to tell Democrats is, okay, you want a two-party system. You want a two-party winner-take-all system. Why do you want the other party to be Republicans? You know,
right.
Democrats are the new Republicans. The
Republican
leadership
and the Republicans have moved even further right.
Right. The Republican leadership are the new fascists. The Democrats are the new Republicans, and there is no left anymore. Now, the Republican rank and file, the average person who still calls themselves a Republican, is still a really decent human being. And they're still thinking things like the Republican Party is the party of Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt. Are you kidding
me?
We couldn't get the national parks now. We couldn't get the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and OSHA, which were signed by Richard Nixon. We couldn't get this stuff now. We couldn't get stamps now. We couldn't get any of this stuff passed now.
That's true.
I interviewed Senator John Lewis a couple of weeks ago when I was in Georgia. I was in Atlanta. And, you know, civil rights leader brought up under the tutelage of Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. And he said he's a seated congressman, 5th District, Georgia. He said Congress does not reflect the values of the American people, period.
Wow. Yes, I know who he is. I've seen him speak, you know, quite often. But for him to actually admit that and say that, wow, that's really
he
something.
He said the people have to be willing to get in the street and get in trouble. He got in trouble. He got beaten bloody by the KKK. He got in the street. He got in trouble, and things changed. And he said, people aren't willing to get in trouble anymore. We've got to get in trouble. And he said, and people got to keep writing about it. And so if folks are interested, if probably, you know, a little bit goes a long way. But I have a blog at the Huffington Post with a whole pile of stories and a lot of these interviews there. I just got back from West Virginia a number of weeks ago where I worked on the mountaintop removal stuff and wrote some stories with that. And I'm off on a new trip where I'm going to write about the history of the labor movement in the United States. And we've just got to keep writing about it. Where did your job go? They're union busting all over this country, and those unions need to get stronger. They need to get into Walmart. They need to get into Dunkin' Donuts. A person at Dunkin' Donuts can work an entire hour and not be able to afford the drink they're making.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, a fancy latte is $7. They're going to take home $4.50.
Isn't that something? It's really crazy. Oh, I meant to tell you about Congressman Lewis. I wasn't sure if you knew this, but he actually went to the Occupy Atlanta, because I remember seeing the videos of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that were at Occupy Atlanta asked him to leave. So they didn't want any elected officials there, and they asked him to leave. And he really didn't want to leave, but he said, you know, for the good of the people that are here and for the good of Occupy, I will go ahead and leave. And he left at that point. But I thought that was quite commendable, because there were very, very few elected officials that would go down to the Occupy movements in various cities and actually interact with the people. But he was one of them that was that really made an attempt to do that. And I thought his heart was in the right place. So I thought that was pretty good.
I think his heart's been in the right place for a long time. And as I mentioned Bernie Sanders earlier, there are Conyers from Michigan, Mike Michaud from Maine. There are Congress people and there are one or two senators that belong there. And the rest
of them. Kucinich is another one who has tirelessly worked for, you know, I mean, I worked on his 2008 campaign, was one of his staffers, but, we lost her again. Pat, give a call back, or we lost somebody. Are you there, Pat?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. We lost another caller. But there was a caller that was there, but they were dropped. But anyway, Dennis Kucinich read the 35 articles of impeachment, you know, to make that a record on the House floor. And, of course, it was right after that when Pelosi said she was taking impeachment off the table. So at that point, the issue was moved.
Well, then they took Dennis Kucinich off the table, right? They gerrymandered him out of it.
Dennis Kucinich off the table.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really funny. For the couple of years that I worked for him, one of my best friends said to me, she said, I think there's greater things in store for Dennis. And she said, and the fact that he didn't make president, you know, and he probably won't be in Congress much longer, this was some time ago. She said, I think he can do greater work outside of Congress and without those limitations. So, you know, we're waiting to see what he can do as a just Dennis Kucinich, you know, citizen at large.
Yeah, I'm frustrated, but this is another frustration I have with the Democratic Party. Dennis Kucinich should have picked up his carpet bag and moved to Maine and run for the U.S. Senate seat that was vacated there. There are a lot of things that the Democratic Party could do if they actually wanted to do something to represent the people and get the right people into office. And the Democrats were just as happy to see Kucinich go as the Republicans were.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's the Democratic leadership, of course, that I'm talking about. And so at some point, the average rank-and-file person has to stop tolerating this. And
Cynthia McKinney had made a comment to me, you know, because I worked with her for a while, but she had made a comment to me about just the Democratic Party in general, and she said she made a comment about somebody coming to work for her that probably was a Democrat, and she said, but Anita, she said, if they come to work for me, she said, I might not be that right person, or if they go to work with a Democrat, that Democrat might not be the right Democrat. She made that very, very, very clear that if this person was going to work with anybody, they had to be the right Democrat. Otherwise, they wouldn't work with them. So I thought,
language is important, too, because the average Democrat and the average Republican are still our brothers and sisters in this country. And for the most part, they want what we want, which is our kids to be happy and healthy. The problem is because we're all seen as enemies, each other's kids are not happy and healthy. And so it's the I got mines pushing us to think, oh, my God, I got to get mine. I got to get mine and stop worrying about yours. And that's not true. We can't worry about only our own. We have to worry about everybody. We have to intersect. Charter schools that exclude kids that can't afford to be in them, those kids are still going to end up in the backseat with your kid eventually selling them drugs, like it or lump it. You can't turn your back on your fellow man. You can't do it. It's wrong. It's wrong just ethically, but it's wrong for you. It's wrong for you to turn your back on your fellow man, and I don't know how to get people to care about that.
So it's kind of like Hillary was right when she wrote that book that was called It Takes a Village to Raise a Child.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she was basically talking about community. And I believe that, too. That's why I feel so strongly about, you know, initiatives that are community-based, like transition towns and things like that, where communities are coming together and working together to come up with alternative solutions to any community problem that they may have that they may all solve together. And I'm looking to working even more. Transition Tampa just became official, for instance, and I'm on the steering group for that. And very interesting for anybody that has not read the books, anybody that happens to be listening. That's another, some other books to add to the summer reading list would be Transition Town by Rob Hopkins, a new way of looking at community organizing, and really enjoy that initiative. So we're at a little bit over an hour. Do you want to keep going, or did you have anything else you wanted to add? I'd like to hear about some of the stories that are on Huffington Post, personally.
Oh, yeah, well, I've been running for them for a couple of years now, so there's a lot of stuff up there. And I also write for a really wonderful news magazine called New Clear Vision. Sounds like nuclear fusion. I don't know if they did that on purpose, but or nuclear fusion, but it's New Clear Vision. It's out of Prescott, Arizona, and it's just news for people who want to be uplifted. It's news for people. It's all good stories, good things, happy. I mean, some of the stories are bleak, but they at least there's a motivating and an action point at the end, and it's written by a lot of really great scholars, and I'm flattered that they include me on the writing. So you can just go to, I have my own page at the Huffington Post. It's just huffingtonpost.com/Pat-LaMarche. I do need to run, but I did just want to say one thing, which was, follow Diane Nyland, go to hearus.us and check out what she's doing for homeless kids. Follow us on Facebook, Diane and I together, the Babes of Wrath are on Epic Journey 10 at Facebook. You can friend me on Facebook, just my name, Pat LaMarche. But then also I am taking off again in about a month to do this history of the labor movement. And we're still just putting final ink on the trip around the country. So if you have a suggestion, we want to try and fit it in. We are going to go down to West Texas. We're going to go to Waco. We're going to see where the fertilizer plant blew up and all those people who are victims of corporate terrorism. We don't call it that, of course. We're going to talk to real people, and I'll be writing a book about that too. So, yeah. And Anita,
so you just don't stop. You just keep going like the Energizer Bunny.
Well, I have admired you for so long and the work that you've done, and your determination and your personal story that you were sharing tonight about how this isn't a cakewalk for you either. But we're in it together, and I love you, and I think you're great, and I'm going to keep following you and watching what you're up to.
Yeah, I'll be very honest. It's been a tough year and a half, and if I, if I didn't get that widow's pension, I'd be homeless too. So I'm sitting here, and I can tell you the organization that's helped me immensely, and now I'm actually working with them, is a little tiny Roman Catholic church down the street, and I'm working with St. Vincent de Paul that operates outside of that church. And they've been just marvelous to me. So I know there's certain groups there that are not always faith-based. They don't always have to be faith-based, but some of them are. And I just highly commend St. Vincent de Paul, at least the group that's working out of this church. They're very helpful to the community and not judgmental and just there for people in need. Eternally grateful to them. And then, of course, once I'm up on my feet again, I keep praying for that, job that'll at least, get me so I'm not treading water. But once that happens, I will definitely be going into the community even with more of a vengeance to help the homeless in Tampa.
I love that.
I've become so close to that whole situation. There by the grace of God go I. It can happen to any of us. I mean, we're all a paycheck away. So
Diane says, start a compassion epidemic.
I love that. I love the way she words things. She's just absolutely marvelous. And I'm so glad the two of you are doing your thing and doing your traveling. But I will definitely post the links under the blog post that you just mentioned so people can look you up and take the link also and forward it around so people can hear the interview.
So great. I'll get a hold of you when I have more information on this upcoming tour and keep in touch with you on that.
Yeah, because maybe I can interview you guys when you're on the tour, which
that'd be
would be even cooler, you know,
yep,
is catch you while you're on the road and get both you and Diane on the air at the same time. That'd be great.
Okay, so great. Take care, Anita.
All right. Thank you so much, Pat. You have a great weekend, and we'll have you on the show again whenever you want. Okay?
Okay, wonderful. Yep, thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye. And that was Pat LaMarche, our guest for the Wise Women Media radio show for this installment. I wanted to remind you all to go to wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com, which is where you can find us on the net. And please help to donate and keep us on the air. There is a GoFundMe little box there with my picture. I'm wearing a hat. You click on the green button that says GoFundMe, and it'll take you right to a form to sign in. Any little amount will do, $5, $10, to help keep us on the air. It's seed money. Basically, what I do with it is I pay the internet access with any money that I receive. So I want to thank again our sponsors, the Here Be Monsters Network, and we hope to see you again next week with another show. But in the meantime, I'm going to close with a song by Grace Potter. She did a fabulous cover of Fly Me to the Moon. So here that is, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Door. In other words,